Please open your hearts and your purses to a man who is misunderstood. He gets all the kicks and the curses, though he wishes you nothing but good. Well, he wistfully begs you to show him you think he's a friend, not a louse. So remember the debt that you owe him, the landlord who lends you his house. So pity the downtrodden landlord and his back that is burdened and bent. Respect his gray hairs, don't ask for repairs, and don't be behind with the rent.
You ready? Good afternoon, Santa Cruz. It's every other Sunday again, and the beginning of the second week of the Great Lockdown. I want to welcome you to Sustainability Now, a biweekly program on environment and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschutz. My guest today is UCSC Associate Professor of Sociology, Steve McKay. Are you there, Steve?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay. He's director of the UCSC Center for Labor Studies and author of Satanic Mills or Silicon Island, The Politics of High-Tech Production in the Philippines. Steve is also co-director with Professor Miriam Greenberg of No Place Like Home, a community-initiated, student-engaged research project on Santa Cruz's affordable housing crisis. Steve, welcome to Sustainability Now.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me, Ronnie.
So why don't you we start by you telling us about your background, your education and career at UCSC, and how you got into sociology.
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in the Bay Area. I was born in San Francisco and a product of California public schools. Went to high school in Richmond, and I went to UC Berkeley for my bachelor's. I started in 1985, and I studied political economy. And after spending some time there, I really wanted to get an idea. I'd studied kind of development and especially community development, and wanted to understand it in other parts of the world. So I spent 2 years after my bachelor's working in Indonesia with a local non-governmental organization. And I think that's really where my interest in community-based projects started. After several years there, I came back to the United States working with other NGOs to support international development. And I ended up being interested in sociology, partly because it was the broadest discipline I could figure out to be in, but also because it took the issues of development and sort of the larger political economy and structures that influence local development. I was really trying to connect that always, and sociology seemed to allow me to kind of dig deeper into sort of to try to investigate the idea of international development with a pretty clear focus on development, you know, for who and who gets to define that development.
Mm-hmm.
So much of my work has been around kind of that theme, but in many different areas of the world. So much of my work is focused on labor and migration. As you mentioned, my first book was on the Philippines, on the electronics industry. But I came to Santa Cruz in 2007, so just before the last crash, and it's in the sociology department. And since being at Santa Cruz, I became director of the Center for Labor Studies, and that's where I really got interested in tying together kind of interests around the world about labor issues, but then working locally with a bunch of different organizations and groups that had ties to an interest in labor. And so that's how I really kind of came to kind of focusing on community issues in Santa Cruz, but connected to the world.
So what is No Place Like Home? What's the problem? How do you approach it? Who's done the research?
Yeah, so No Place Like Home, again, I did my real shout out to my collaborator, Professor Miriam Greenberg, who's been working with me. She couldn't join us today. But basically, I had done another project before this, starting in about 2014, called Working for Dignity. And this project was to better understand. We were approached by some local folks at the California Rural Legal Assistance. The attorney there, Gretchen Regenhardt, had been attending some conferences we had about labor, and she came to us with a question, which was, you know, we know that a lot of low-wage workers in agriculture end up in low-wage services. And so she wanted to both find out what was going on in low-wage services and what was it like to be a low-wage service worker in Santa Cruz County, all toward figuring out how to better serve that group as CRLA, California Rural Legal Assistance, provides free legal assistance for low-wage workers. So I did that project along with my students. So over a period of about 2.5 years, about 200 students over that time, we did a survey of what is it like to be a low-wage worker. And so that project, called Working for Dignity, focused on issues like wage theft and low wages. But what we found, and when we talked to 1,200 people in Santa Cruz County, and one of the biggest issues people had was, you know, the issue was they're getting paid very low wages, but they're spending most of their money on housing. And so the number one issue for people about the low wages was they're not able to afford housing. And then that had all kinds of other repercussions.
Yeah.
So that's when in 2016 or so, Miriam and I came to the idea with our community partners. So California Rural Legal Assistance, Community Action Board, and Community Bridges, to better investigate sort of, well, what is it like to be a renter in Santa Cruz County? How does the housing affordability crisis feel to people here in the county? So we found there just wasn't much data on it. There's very little data on, there's some things on affordability. I think we're pretty familiar how much housing costs, often for houses for a lot of us. But we're not always sort of up to speed on what is it like for other people in other conditions, so renters, for example. And there's basically no one doing the research locally, and only spotty data nationally. So we thought, well, in the spirit of our other projects, we would get students working with our community partners and actually go out and talk to renters across the county. Often those folks, low-wage workers and renters in our county, are what might be called difficult to reach or difficult to do research, in part because we have a very vulnerable low-wage population who's not always ready to answer questions. So We know that a lot of the folks in our county are undercounted because they don't necessarily participate in large surveys like the census. So our idea was to go out and be a little more proactive and go into those neighborhoods and those areas where we knew there were a lot of renters and go basically door to door and talk to people about what's their experience. And so that's what No Place Like Home, it's the you know, kind of housing affordability crisis study of Santa Cruz County.
Well, I want to get into the issue of affordability, but before we do that, I'm just curious how you got your students to do this work. Was it through a class or what?
Yeah, so I started teaching a class. First, it was a class on work and labor, and that my students, I thought, to make it real, to understand what it's like to actually go out and talk to people, and that was Working for Dignity. And so I hit on this kind of model of doing research that that we call community-initiated student-engaged research, and that, you know, kind of mouthful we call CISR. And the idea of this is that we have students that have the language and cultural skills to do research and connect with the folks here in Santa Cruz County. And so I recruited students to be part of the course, taught them, you know, research techniques, ethics of research, and all the methodology. And then we would go out through these different courses and go out and use the course as a way for them to learn how to do the research and also connect with our community partners to then go around and do these surveys. So for No Place Like Home, we had over 250 students over about 2.5 years participate in this study.
How did you find, you know, you said the people were might be hard to find and reluctant to answer questions. How did you find them?
Well, so one, we know in terms of people tend to trust those organizations and,
right.
and or that they're either part of, so church groups, for example, or community organizations And so our community partners, those like the Day Worker Center that's run by the Community Action Board, or the Family Resource Center in Live Oak, those places where people are already there, who are already trusted by the community, we get introductions from those community groups. And then our students would then do things like they would actually do neighborhood cleanups. They would do various kind of service projects. They did, for example, a Pathways to College workshop for parents. And the idea was, before we ask them any questions, we want to do something for them first and demonstrate that, you know, we're not there just to extract information, mm-hmm. but actually to, you know, kind of do this along with them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what was fantastic was our students, again, many of them were themselves from immigrant families, for example, that grew up speaking Spanish. And so when we did go door to door in, you know, again, from Santa Cruz all the way through Watsonville and Freedom, they could connect and get people to trust them, I think, better than many if it was just for the census takers or other folks like that. So we feel, partly working through the community organizations, our students were able to get people to trust them and open up about stuff.
Listen, let's take a quick break here before we go on to talk more about affordability. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and KSQD.org. on the internet. Tune in to KSQD Tuesday mornings at 7 for Climate One, when I'm running the station, produced by the Commonwealth Club. Climate One is a forum for candid discussion among climate scientists, policymakers, activists, and concerned citizens, with a focus on energy, economy, and the environment, and politics, I might add. Climate One airs Tuesday mornings at 7 and alternate Mondays at 6 p.m. here on KSQD 90.7 FM. And KSQD.org, one station, many voices, your ink spot on the radio dial. All right, this is Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, and I'm speaking with Professor of Sociology Steve McKay about the project that he co-directs with Professor Miriam Greenberg, who, by the way, is off celebrating a significant birthday. Congratulations, Miriam. No Place Like Home, which is a community-initiated, student-engaged research project on affordable housing in Santa Cruz and Santa Cruz County. So, Steve, affordability is a really tricky notion. I've been looking into it recently, because in particular it differs from one city to the next. So what does it mean in Santa Cruz?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And when we talk about affordability, generally what it comes down to sort of, you know, how much should people be paying for their housing? So that's usually kind of in terms of affordability, you know, is someplace affordable to live? Housing is the number one sort of the biggest expense that most families have, right? So if we look at our monthly, our own monthly budget, you know, the biggest chunk often is for housing, whether it's for a mortgage payment or for rent. And so when we talk about generally affordability, we talk about thinking about the housing cost burden. So how much of your income is going to your housing? And so various measures of affordability usually are some ratio of kind of your income versus how much things cost locally, right? And again, housing, we can look at other elements that go into your cost of living, but housing is the number one for most people. So when we go back to affordability, the housing cost, I mean, it goes way back, right, to at least the Housing Act, 1937, when they, you know, first established public housing, and they had to decide sort of, well, how are they going to do this? Were they going to just give people public housing, or, you know, would there be a maximum income? But they came to the idea, based on even at the time in the 30s, that that you have how much should you be spending in rent? And an old saw was, you should spend about a quarter of your income on housing, because you need the rest of your income for everything else, for food, for clothing, for other things, right? And so the idea, the old one, was 1 week's wages for 1 month's rent. So that idea about a quarter of your expenditure. But in public housing started in the 1930s, really 1940s, the idea was that families shouldn't have to pay more than initially it was just 20% of their income. That was the cutoff, that you shouldn't have to spend more than 20% of your income on rent. So if you could get into public housing because you were poor, you were below a certain income level, they set your rent as a percentage of your income. So if you lost your job, your rent would go down. If you got a raise, your rent would go up. So that was it. In 1968, they raised that level to 25%. So if you're in housing, you should spend 25% of it. And then in 1981, partly because of the crisis and their expenditures, they said, well, you should have to spend 30% of your income on rent. So in 1981, the 30% cutoff was established, and that's where it stays today. So generally, when they talk about affordability, they say your kind of housing cost burden, meaning if you're spending more than 30% of your gross income on your rent and utilities, for example. So that's usually where the affordability comes in. And you can see this also when you're trying to get a, you know, that's just for renters, but in terms of when you're going to try to get a bank loan for a mortgage, right, they want to look at how much your income and how much you're able to do. So similar kind of thing when you're trying to get a mortgage loan, they want you to be able to, you know, keep it at around 30, you know, so usually 25, 30% of your income that you could, you know, pay every month for your mortgage and interest payments.
Well, I mean, I've seen charts about this. Who is in particular is affected by this, this affordability crisis?
Well, I mean, in general, everyone is, right? Because it's sort of anyone who's trying to pay for their housing in some ways and everything else in their lives are affected. But the actual cutoffs, like these official cutoffs, that's for those who are in public housing or are getting a housing voucher, which mm-hmm. is, you know, from the federal government, known as Section 8. So if you're, you know, you have a low enough income to qualify for a housing subsidy, then this is how your rent is determined, right? So there's an income cutoff, and below that income, they're only going to take 30% of your income for your rent.
That's the HUD and California Housing Department criteria,
that's
right?
It's actually HUD. It's the federal criteria. That's
But what I've seen is that, of course, this affects people whose income is higher.
Absolutely. I mean, the affordability, right? So that's just if you can. I mean, we already know, like, you know, for the federal subsidies, there's just not enough of those subsidies. I think there's a, you know, enormous waiting list still in Santa Cruz, and many people who have low enough incomes to qualify for housing subsidies, only, you know, a very few actually, you know, receive those subsidies, right? So that affordability really affects everyone. You could, you know, who's, again, just trying. I mean, I think this is something that we all feel in Santa Cruz, how expensive it is how much, you know, even what's considered, you know, middle class incomes, many people are spending 30 to 50% of their income just on their housing.
What I've seen is that, you know, people who have certain levels of positions, like teachers and police people and the like, are having trouble living in Santa Cruz because of the lack of affordable housing.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, it's definitely not, you know, well, if we adjust for federal poverty lines, usually they determine it nationally, but if you weigh and put into those calculations the cost of housing, Santa Cruz has one of the highest poverty rates in the country, right?
Wow.
Santa Cruz has become really, and for many people, kind of absolutely unaffordable, right? And so we see all kinds of problems that relate to that affordability, that people are having to move further away from their jobs. So you have that, you know, Highway 1, you go on Highway 1 between Santa Cruz and Watsonville anytime after, say, 1:30 or 2 o'clock on a work day, and it's packed because people are, you know, people in Santa Cruz are working over the hill. And then, and that's made Santa Cruz expensive. So people working in Santa Cruz are living in Watsonville. People working in Watsonville are getting pushed down to Salinas, right? So we see all the repercussions of the unaffordability crisis.
It also makes it difficult for employers to keep their employees here. I understand that people have to move away because they just can't find something, or they just can't afford it on the salaries that are being paid.
Absolutely, and we worked with SEIU, you know, Service Employees International Union, who's most of the city and county workers work for. And when we polled and surveyed their members, that was a big issue, that less than half of the people who work for the city of Santa Cruz can afford to live in Santa Cruz. And then when we looked at SEIU members, for example, who worked for Salud para la Gente down in Watsonville, they again have less than half of their people could afford to live in Watsonville. So they were pushed further out. And so, you know, on, and we heard this, the sanitation department, I was talking to some guys in that department, and, you know, in the whole department, there was only one guy who still lived in Santa Cruz. And so this goes for emergency workers too, right? And this has a lot of issues around public health, for example, right now in the pandemic. If someone needs to get to their job, right, but they can't afford to live there, and they're first responders, then they're not able to be there, right, when we need them.
Mm-hmm.
So it really makes sense for a city, right, that think of all the people who are necessary to make the city run, those sanitation workers, the firefighters, the police. If they can't live in the community, that's actually bad for everyone in the community, not just for them, right? And teachers, we see that absolutely a big issue is that the Santa Cruz School District cannot keep teachers because it's actually the most unaffordable place for teachers in the country, right? And I think one thing that's happening is thinking about doing workforce housing. So
uh-huh.
I know one thing that the Santa Cruz County of Education is trying to do is thinking about building housing on some of their land that they control. And, you know, since they're, you know, it's very interesting on the west side, for example, there was a Natural Bridges Elementary School, right, that closed. Well, it closed in part because fewer families can afford to live on the west side. So they were trying to think, well, what could we do with that land? And now they're thinking about and are in plans to develop teacher housing on that site. And so there are some movements toward that in recognizing that it is a big issue for certain employers.
It would be interesting to do a study of the social cost of all of this, you know, because the cost is dumped on the individual. And the individual's family, right? It's not considered to be part of the cost, a broad thing that the community should somehow cover. And I just wonder what that would turn out to be. It's something to think about. Let's talk about the elephant in the room, the university and all of this.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are two ways to think about this. One, of course, is mostly undergraduate enrollments, but also graduate students who are competing for available housing with others. And the other one is, I've forgotten now, there was a second thing. Yes, I remember, you know, how that affects the staff at the university, because they're, of course, we both know that they don't get paid very well. So let's talk a little bit about that. What is the university's role in all of this?
Yeah, no, it's a big question. And I think when we talk about kind of the affordability crisis, so we're not in a housing crisis, we're in an affordable housing crisis.
Yeah, sure.
And so if we're looking at that, you know, you want to look as we would kind of as what's, you know, where did we get, how did we get here? And what's been, you know, what's pushing those prices so high, that affordability problem? And clearly, it's both a problem on both the demand side and the supply side. And so if we start with looking at kind of a confluence of factors, you know, again, over a long period, we definitely have to factor in the university in rising demand, right? So that clearly one of the issues in pushing the rise of demand is students. But they're only one contributor. So that's we definitely want to talk about kind of the elephant in a room, but we have to recognize the other elephants.
Sure.
And so, you know, we will also look at, you know, kind of the rise of Silicon Valley and the, you know, for as expensive as it is here, it's even more expensive over the hill, right? And so so that's one of the big pushes on demand as well. And both for, you know, kind of single-family homes, but also for rentals. And then the other thing is, you know, Santa Cruz is a beach town. There's a lot of short-term rentals. And so a lot of the rise of Airbnb, a lot of housing that might have been used for, you know, long-term renters, you know, regular people who live here, got converted to Airbnb and other kind of vacation rentals. And so that also kind of meant that there were fewer units for renters because of the, you know, the entrance of Airbnb. But students, absolutely. And again, it's not just students, but it's also faculty and staff, right, that as the university has expanded, they're only, we house at UCSC half of all our undergraduates on campus, and that's actually higher than all the other UCs. So we actually house more students on campus than other universities. But given how big we are, even half is still a lot, right, that the other half are living off campus. And so they're definitely adding to the demand in Santa Cruz. So that they absolutely are part of it. And one of the reasons we did the project, actually, in working with our students was students are often the kind of the face of or often get the blame for the affordability crisis. And we wanted to be people in town to be able to actually talk to some students. And so the students were going door to door, and you know, it was a pretty tough job because when they would come to a door and say, hey, I'm here to talk about affordability crisis, and many doors were slammed in their faces or they were yelled at and told, you know, the problem with housing is you students. And the students, you know, took it with a grain of salt, but they also got into a lot of conversations with people who live in Santa Cruz. And I think one of the things that happened out of the project was people in town started seeing a lot of these students as fellow renters. So rather than part of the problem, there started to be connections between students as renters and locals as renters. And in fact, in Santa Cruz, in the city of Santa Cruz, renters now make up 60% of the population, right? So we're actually a majority renter city. But it was often kind of local activists and renters often blame students for the problem. And what we saw in the last couple of years is that students and other renters actually started getting together and instead of blaming each other, started trying to work together on the other areas. And that's the sort of supply side that, I don't know, we can talk about the supply side as well. That's really important.
Yeah, let's come back to that in a minute, okay? You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and KSQD.org on the internet. You're listening to Sustainability Now here on KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz. Emily, the engineer, and I are trying to figure out what that last message was all about, and we haven't. But anyway, this is Ronnie Lipschitz, and I'm speaking with Professor of Sociology Steve McKay about the project he co-directs with Miriam Greenberg at the university, No Place Like Home. And we were just talking about the affordable housing demand side of the equation. Steve, one thing I wanted to bring up is that the university is now working on its long-range development plan through 2040. And are working with a projection of about 10,000 additional students without really making clear where they're going to be housed. So, you know, if we go back to that 50% number, that still means that there are going to be about 5,000 people coming into the community. How's that going to what kind of impact is that going to have? I mean, I don't want to blame the students, all right? I actually want to blame geography, but I'll come back to that in a moment.
Yeah, no, it's you know, the long range, that number has, you know, wow, people were shocked with that number. And you know, it's like you say, in terms of geography or whatever, it's going to have an impact, that number. And so we've seen some other campuses that have done various, you know, kind of memorandums of understanding between the cities. So I'm thinking of UC Davis, for example, where they're, you know, kind of, they have to account for, you know, the impact to every student they add in housing. So there are kind of kind of models to go out there in terms of planning? How do you plan it? I mean, one thing is California is not shrinking and the population is going to UC. So one, you know, thing is they just shouldn't come, right? That we should stop allowing more students. And, you know, while I understand that and that there is this restriction kind of by geography, the same token, you know, it's already UC's only let in 10% of the students, you know, from high school. So to restrict and just say, well, you know, we're full, we can't take anymore, really doesn't, it's not what the, you know, the university public system is about, right? They still need to accommodate the students and the families and the, you know, of California in the UC system. So I think we do have to deal with it, and that's not, you know, it's not going to go away. We can't say just simply we can't take that many. We have to, it's more about planning for, you know, that kind of rise over that length of time. And so some of it is building more affordable student housing, and that's something that is in almost no one's vocabulary except right. for Miriam and I, yeah. is the idea of affordable student housing. Because, you know, now they're under pressure to actually, you know, that all housing needs to make money or at least support itself. And they're moving to public-private partnerships and other kind of models. But for the most part, you know, rent on campus is always more expensive than it is in town in almost every market, right? And that often ends up driving the cost of the local market. We've heard landlords say, yeah, we index our rent to the cost of the dorms. Mm. And it's actually been higher.
The state actually requires that student housing pay for itself. It's treated as a separate category from capital improvement on the university campuses. So you know, I part of that has to do with the cost of building the Student Housing West project, which is supposed to start last year. Who knows when it will start? Is quite expensive over the lifetime of the project. And relies on that continuing flow of rents in order to be financed. So it's a kind of a circle there. The university ought to be looking into strategies for building low cost housing, probably in the town. We can come back to talk about that in a moment. I know that the LRDP envisions 4 new colleges as well. And I don't think anybody is quite sure where the funds for that are going to come from. So let's talk about the supply side now, okay?
Yeah.
What, first of all, how do I put this? You know, what is responsible for just the general high cost of housing in Santa Cruz? I mean, I know partly it's supply, but it seems to me that, you know, if the market works as it's supposed to, right? People should be building housing like crazy. So, right? Why doesn't that happen? Let's start with that one.
Yeah. So, Santa Cruz is fascinating for this, and this is something that Miriam and I, since the survey, have gotten digging more in, and Miriam really has done a lot of this work, and so. I'm just going to summarize some of the things. But on the supply side, it's a really interesting because Santa Cruz is, we've been writing something about this. You know, there's a book, very well-known book about Santa Cruz by Richard Gendron and Bill Domhoff called The Leftmost City, right? Power and Progressive Politics. And Miriam and I are in the middle of writing something now, and who gets to live in the leftmost city, right? And which is sort of the housing politics that came out of that. So if you read that book and look at it, it's very instructive for thinking about kind of what happened in Santa Cruz. And the basic, you know, punchline is Santa Cruz as the leftmost city, you know, with these progressives, got together with neighborhood groups and were able to stop the growth machine, kind of the idea of, you know, the Lighthouse Field was going to become a convention center, mm-hmm. you know, and basically in the 70s, Santa Cruz progressives got together with neighborhood groups and defeated a lot of those kind of typical growth machine, kind of business oriented, you know, large scale development. And so in some ways it was good, right? The idea is you defeated bad development. Now the problem came though, is that then when it came to then think, okay, well, if we're going to, you know, keep out bad development, just very high-end. There was some vision that, well, we need to have, some development for, like, affordable housing and things like that. And what happened was, in many ways, in Santa Cruz, that the progressives were often doing this in the name of environmentalism. So they mm-hmm. passed measures J and O in the 1980s, right, that helped create a green belt. So the idea is you should maintain areas that should not be built. But when you do that, then you have to have, okay, well, what you have to build in some areas. And so they created in J and O the idea of an urban services line, right? And the idea was to promote development along transportation corridors, right? So the idea was planning the development. So that was the idea. But then as they started trying to build along those transit corridors, the neighborhood organizations that were really instrumental in keeping out bad development ended up sort of pushing very hard to not to allow any development, particularly multifamily homes, right? And so what happened was neighborhood groups had changed the Santa Cruz general plan to protect single-family home zoning in most of the city, making it very difficult for developers to assemble the parcels necessary to build apartment buildings, right? So like you're saying, it would seem like people would jump in this market and build, given that you can make so much. But the zoning makes it very difficult, actually. So you have height limits, you have difficulty assembling parcels. And then in 1994, at the county level, they moved to downzone the unincorporated areas in the county, right, which are massive. So Live Oak, for example, that area is all unincorporated. Mm-hmm. And downzoning means that it was all designated for single-family homes on large lots, right? Mm-hmm. So at the same time as you had a greenbelt, right, so you couldn't build in that area and along the coast in those fragile eco areas, but they also downzoned any urban areas, too. So you basically couldn't build multifamily housing anywhere. And much of that, again, was sort of, again, this progressive coalition that helped keep out bad development turned out to be not able to deliver any affordable development. And that's the main reason why we're in the problem we're in now.
Does the cost of land have anything to do with this?
Absolutely. Cost of land also is makes building expensive. So this is where you said, why doesn't the market take care of it? Well, because the market for land, again, because the way the zoning is, so land parcels are very expensive. So for any developer to make their money back, they're going to aim at the very high end of the market, right? Mm-hmm. So you look at the Pacific Apartments down to end of Pacific there, any of the newer developments, things are so expensive that then they have to charge a very high price to make that back. And so basically the market never delivers affordable housing. No developer wants to build affordable housing. There's demand there, but they're not going to recoup their investments. So left to its own devices, and this is what the YIMBYs, the Yes in My Backyard folks, say, well, we just need more housing, all housing. Well, if you do that without any regulation, all you're going to get is very high-end housing, right?
Right,
And so you see some of that, kind of development. And then you start seeing some investors come in. So the Outlook Apartments, for example, on the west side, Drive.
Where all the students live,
Right. Well, so that was sold in 2018, right? And it wasn't clear who bought it. They sold it for $55 million, and now it's called the Hilltop Apartments.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were curious, and one of my students was curious to find out, well, who was it that bought that, right? That was really expensive. It's a big kind of thing. Maybe they could put in some affordable units, so there was a glimmer of hope that maybe the new owners would, price it where it could be affordable. Well, it turns out when in tracking from the address of the LLC that it was Goldman Sachs, right, from New York, that purchased it for $55 million. And they immediately they renovated some of the apartments and immediately raised the rent. And so now one-bedroom apartments at the Hilltop Apartments go for $2,500 to $3,000 a month for a one-bedroom apartment. Two-bedroom apartments are up to $4,000 a month, right? So that's the level, that's where people are jumping into the market.
That's about what my son pays in San Jose, actually.
Yeah.
So, let's To what degree are outside investors coming into the housing market in Santa Cruz? I mean, that's really interesting. And I read that, you know, various financial corporations are looking at real estate as the, well, we'll see what happens, of course, but as the next gold mine, basically. To, you know, how widespread is that in Santa Cruz? Do you have any sense?
It's a good question. We're trying to actually figure that out. I think after we, you know, did this whole project where we, you know, so for No Place Like Home, we talked to 1,700 renters, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So we really wanted to understand it from the renter's point of view. But if we learn anything from the project, right, it was that, well, renters aren't driving this market. It's the producers and the managers of housing that are doing it, right? And so we're now looking, and it's much, much harder to figure out who owns what, for example, right? Look at when the city council just tried to have a rent, you know, renter registry. So not, they weren't trying to, you know, no rent control, nothing. They just wanted to register of who is renting what.
Mm-hmm.
And all the landlords balked and, you know, protested that they don't want to even have that, collect that data, right? So we actually have a pretty poor idea. So you can go and find out, you know, again, like the Outlook Apartments, now the Hilltop Apartments, you can go and look up who owns it. But there's so many shell companies, right? It takes a while to figure out who owns what. And so that it could be pretty difficult to figure out. But in terms of, like, Santa Cruz becoming this investor's area, we definitely see that happening in different ways. So Silicon Valley realtors working with local realtors, and, you know, there have been ads saying, you know, we're bringing Silicon Valley, you know, buyers into Santa Cruz. And so there's definitely been a lot of kind of focus on, you know, bringing more investors in. Whether those are their bank investors, you know, we just don't know how many are actually being done by sort of financial organizations. But one curious way that we found how influential outside investors and interests are was around the Measure M, right? The rent control and just cause eviction measure failed. And what we did was just looking at who financed that campaign. And if we look at it, and again, they outspent the Yes on M campaign, which is a completely local campaign, right, that raised about $50,000 to run that campaign. Well, the No on M campaign raised nearly $1 million, right? So outspent nearly 20-1. And mm-hmm. but of course, you have to register where those donations are coming from. And so when we looked at it, and this was even before the final tally was in, when it was about $750,000, they had just before the election in November, so this was like October 2018, they had to register who their donations were coming from, right? At the time, again, they had $750,000. Well, the California Apartment Association had put in over $350,000, right, to defeat any kind of rent control in Santa Cruz, right? So there's no way. And now the local realtors, they were able to, you know, raise some money locally too, but nothing on that scale.
Mm-hmm.
And the largest single donor was the National Association of Realtors. That they just the National Association of Realtors had contributed more than $200,000, right? And so it was. And then the next largest was the California Association of Realtors. So you saw, you know, a lot of outside interests that were both the apartment associations, so those who own and run apartments, but also the real estate interests at the national and state level were very, very much involved in trying to defeat any regulation on rent and eviction, particularly in Santa Cruz.
Okay, let me take a quick break, okay? You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and KSQD.org on the internet. The second and fourth Sundays of the month, KSQD presents Faith Matters, hosted by Seth Shapiro. Faith Matters is an interfaith discussion with leaders from a variety of religious and spiritual traditions. The discussion is wide-ranging and respectful. Tune into Faith Matters Sunday evening at 6 in 15 minutes on KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org. KSQD, many voices, one station, the ink spot on your dial. You're listening to Sustainability Now. This is Ronnie Lipschitz, and I am speaking with Professor Steve McKay, who is the co-director with Miriam Greenberg of No Place Like Home, a community-initiated, student-engaged research project on affordable housing in Santa Cruz. And we've just been talking about outside money and its influence. You mentioned the, was it Proposition M? You mentioned the discussion about a rental registry, and I couldn't help but think about the gun owners who are afraid the government is going to come and, you know, pry guns from their cold, dead hands. It sort of sounds very much the same. So let's talk about solutions. Okay. What sorts of things, have you thought about or supported or proposed?
I mean, this is really important. And I think it's, you know, it just says how complex the problem is, that the solutions have to be similarly kind of complex. But we tend to boil it down, and we have a large section, again, my colleague Miriam Greenberg helped put this together, really, on our website. So if you go to No Place Like Home, so without spaces, just noplacelikehome.ucsc.edu, we have a whole policy tools section. And the way it's organized and the way we tend to think about it, as a lot of folks who are, you know, kind of doing this work on affordable housing, is to think of it as the three P's, okay? So production, preservation, and protection. And so let me just run through quick, because the idea is that you need kind of policy on all three of these if you're going to, you know, really deliver affordable housing. And, you know, this was one of the big issues with the Measure M, the rent control, and those who were against it were always saying, well, if you have rent control, landlords are going to drop out of the market. It's going to reduce supply. You're going to end up going to drive up rents and hurting the people that you most want to help. And that's, you know, in a very isolated way, you know, it could have some of those dynamics. But the idea is that protection of tenants through rent control is really an immediate important thing to do, because in the current market, that they're the most vulnerable. So in terms of we kind of think of short and long term, medium term and long term. So you need protection of tenants first before you do anything, right? And one of the main things is protection against kind of, you know, exorbitant rent rises and, you know, kind of forced moves and evictions. So protection is one thing. And so that's why, you know, we were supportive of the Measure M, and because it did protect tenants. But that's only one P. So the other key P really is production. And so you need more production of new affordable housing. And that could be on campus, right? Again, we need to deal with it the student way. So the university needs to be part of this conversation of developing affordable student housing. But also the county and city of Santa Cruz and the state of California, right, and the federal government need to be, you know, make it more possible to deliver, you know, sort of more affordable housing. So on the production side, you know, that we've lost a lot of tools to the, you know, federal government has basically disinvested in affordable housing, now moving more toward this voucher system where, you know, if you qualify for it, you're able to get a voucher apartment complexes, landlords aren't required to honor those vouchers. So, you know, one thing is producing more affordable housing. And this is where cities and counties could actually build, you know, 100% affordable housing. The problem was the redevelopment agencies that used to make that possible, right, in 2011, because of the financial crisis, Governor Brown, you know, basically got rid of the redevelopment agencies. So locations now just don't have very many tools to do it. They can't themselves. So they use inclusionary zoning. And so we have seen that in Santa Cruz, the inclusionary zoning has gone from what was practically 10%, it's doubled to 20%. So that's one way to do it. But they also could do other things. And I think this is where trying to build more affordable housing, being creative, like the school district building workforce housing for its teachers, the city and county And it comes down again to who controls land. If we can figure out for the folks who control land to allow or to invest in housing and let that housing be taken off the market, right, so it's not directly a market good, then you can produce some, you know, kind of affordable housing in perpetuity, right? So,
what do you mean by taking it off the market? You mean basically it's not available for sale or speculation. Is that what you mean?
Exactly what I mean. So, so for example, how this the teacher housing. Well, for example, I'll take it even closer to home. I live in faculty housing, right? My faculty housing, I own my house, but I don't own the land that it sits on.
Right.
It sits on land from... So I get the benefits of homeownership. I get to deduct my interest payments from my taxes, but I can't sell it to anyone I want. With the idea is that I bought it at below cost as a faculty person. I have to sell it back to the university. But it also doesn't accrue. It doesn't accrue profit like you would in the open market. It only increases the value at the rate of inflation so that the next professor who moves in here is going to pay basically the same cost in that future ton that I paid when I bought it, right? So that idea is that it remains affordable, but it's restricted, right, to faculty.
So this would be... So this would be something, for instance, available to teachers. One question about that, and this has been raised in another context, not on the show, but are there, you know, if since you're living on the campus, the university controls that. If you're building something in the city, on which is essentially public land, is restricting housing like that, let's say, to teachers, regarded as housing discrimination?
Well. It's not housing discrimination. Again, it depends on who controls it. So most of the models, they have to have, it's not because, so school districts own the land. So it's not really fully public land. It's owned by the district.
Yeah.
So they can use it. And usually it's also teachers and staff. Same with faculty and staff housing. So it's not just, you know, one group, but anyone. But this is something the county is thinking about, right? The county could identify parcels of land that they control, and this was something that the union was very interested in, that they could work together to help develop, you know, county worker housing, you know, in the county that would, you know, both be, that the both the union would be interested in it, and from polling their employees, they were definitely interested in it. And the county has access to land that they could use to do this. And the idea is that, you know, again, priority given to those who serve the public in the county. So think about teachers. You think about those emergency workers or other county health workers, for example. Right. So there are a number of different models. And then, again, it doesn't have to be restricted. There's also the idea of doing community land trusts. So public, private groups could do the same thing. And this is now a group in Santa Cruz trying to develop an affordable housing model using the community land trust model, where they would purchase land or try to have maybe someone would donate land, but then they would do something similar where they would build housing, but it would have certain restrictions, but it would also remain affordable.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I might as well put a pitch in here for a project I'm working on, which is to try and facilitate construction of large numbers of accessory dwelling units in backyards, to get homeowners to sort of buy into this idea of community well-being and welfare. And that then, of course, addresses, again, this issue of the land ownership. What's the plan for your project, No Place Like Home? What are you doing next with it?
Well, I think we are looking at some of these other areas, trying to understand. One, for example, Miriam, after all this, has joined. She is now on the city planning commission.
Right, yeah.
So she actually is, you know, elbows deep every day in trying to help deliver some of these projects, you know, understanding. And so part of it is staying definitely deeply engaged locally. Now that we have a better understanding of what it's like, to be involved. And so there we've been, you know, we've brought people to talk about community land trusts to help set up land trusts here. We put people, you know, different organizations in touch with groups that are further along in the area, other parts of the Bay Area. We're still active with tenant organizations that are, you know, still active on thinking about the protection of tenants, because that's still clearly a big issue for a lot of people. And I think, but we are interested on an academic kind of level, thinking about this idea of who gets to live in the leftmost city. What is the future of a place like Santa Cruz that paints itself as progressive, yet is, you know, incredibly unequal, and is completely unaffordable? You know, how could we return to a kind of putting together, thinking about what coalitions could deliver affordability, right, in kind of creative ways? And I think that's, you know, as we go forward, we're still going to do the academic side. But it's really trying to think, okay, you know, what are those three P's? How might we be involved and, you know, help realize some of those models here locally? So, I think this is one thing about being here that, you know, involved in a local project. We're still very connected with the community organizations we work with. And so we're here for the long haul. Mm-hmm. In that sense, we don't want the university to at all be, let off the hook. But we also feel the university could play a real role in trying to figure out some of these things. And again, just like we saw with the students, I think if we work, the university and some of us in it, work closely with the city and county and other organizations, I mean, we could kind of pull this together and try to think, you know, in many ways, outside of the typical development box for how to kind of deliver the affordability that Santa Cruz really needs.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time, but thank you, Steve, for being on Sustainability Now. As he mentioned, you can find information about No Place Like Home by looking at noplacelikehome.ucsc.edu. 2 weeks from today, my guest is going to be our own engineer, Emily Dunham, who's going to talk about her doctoral research up at the university on kelp forests and sea urchins. She told me she's got a whole bunch of sea urchins up on the campus and the condition of the California coast. So that's on Sunday, April 5th, 5 to 6 p.m. right here on KSQD 90.7 FM on your dial and ksqd.org. And by the way, the station is rebroadcasting Sunday shows from this particular slot on Tuesday mornings from 6 to 7 a.m. for all of those of you who are getting up early, even though the great hunkering down is still going on. So until next time, until next every other Sunday, Sustainability Now.
Please open your hearts and your purses to a man who is misunderstood. He gets all the kicks and the curses, though he wishes you nothing but good. Well, he wistfully begs you to show him you think he's a friend, not a louse. So remember the debt that you owe him, the landlord who lends you his house.
You've been listening to Sustainability Now with Ronnie Lipschitz here at KSQD Santa Cruz.